please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Bob from the Connect the Dots group in Las Vegas, Nevada.
My name is Bob Darrell and I am alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was very afraid to believe in, that I've accessed through 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in our book, good sponsorship, and a persistent and consistent commitment to the primary purpose of helping other drunks. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And for that, I owe you. I owe you my life and my freedom. And freedom is probably the more important of the two, because a life of abstinence without freedom drives some of us to stick pistols in our mouth. It'll drive you crazy enough to, you know that thing you swore you'd never take again or pick up again? It'll drive you back to it, as it did me. I'm delighted to be here. I was expecting like five people in a field. Well, this is another example of what do I know. Where else am I going to go? I want to thank the group for inviting me here to speak, and also for having the integrity and the belief in the third tradition and the long form and the seventh tradition to have offered to pay for my hotel room last night so I'd stay over an extra day. Not because I wouldn't do that, but because the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're self-supporting. We don't ever want to have a fellowship that you only ever hear from rich people. We want the guy who works in Walmart to have just as much a chance of speaking in your home group as the guy in the $2 million home. And the integrity, that way nobody owns us and nobody has control here. And that's the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am proud to be part of an organization that has that kind of integrity. I mean, it is so bizarre that AA is the only organization on the planet that has actually hired attorneys and spent money to not take money that's been willed to us. Tell that to a minister at your church about how we spent a lot of money not to take some money. They'll go, what? But that is our integrity. That we run our own ship here. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. Matter of fact, the AA will only let you contribute so much in a year. They don't want any more, which is pretty cool. I know there's a couple new people here. And there's a couple new people here that didn't raise their hand because you didn't think it was anybody's business when you had your last beer. I'm with you. I'm that guy. I don't know what business. I'm not going to raise my hand. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is different. There's no place like this. You may have been to church. You may have been to Amway. You may have been to a lot of places. This is very, very different. It's the only place I know of on the planet, because of our second tradition, where you come in a big shot and you work your way up to servant. And that's as high as you get here. It's great. Where's a crazy place? You get a new guy comes in. Every new guy wants to know who's in charge, because you got to get hooked up with the guy in charge to get a little juice, a little leverage. Who's the guy in charge? God. Of course he is. Who's really in charge? You mean like who's top of the food chain here? The speaker. Is the speaker? No, not the speaker. He's so self-centered, we just give him something to do. Not the speaker. You know the guy cleaning the bathrooms? He's probably at the top of the food chain here, because he is a servant. And there is no difference in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope we never get to a point where we think that there is, between the guy who runs his mouth in the meeting and the guy who cleans the bathrooms. It's all service. It's all saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all part of whatever contribution you're asked of you, that you say yes and you give it freely. and you give it, you know, sometimes in a spirit of self-sacrifice, sometimes in inconvenience, sometimes it costs you, but you give it because AA saves our life. And most of us fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't see how you can't fall in love. If AA has done for you what it's done for me and done for the people you've come to love and sponsor here, and you watch what happens in their lives, my God, how could you not love AA? How could you not want to respect this thing that is so magnificent? I got a coat and tie on. There was a time in my life where I was made to go, as an alternative to this terrible juvenile detention place. I had to go to another school that was harsh and had a lot of discipline. They made me wear a coat and tie every day. I swore to myself, if I ever get out of this place, I am never going to wear a coat and tie again. I put one on tonight. And I put one on tonight because the truth is, there's not a lot I could do to show respect to AA. But I'll do anything I can. So I little gestures like that, little demonstrations have become important to me. I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I came in here, I've got a deja vu experience in this pavilion. I remembered something that was a very horrific experience for me. I was living in another part of Pennsylvania. I was sleeping in the park. I think I was an unrealized outdoorsman. I don't know. Sleeping in this park, right? And I came to, and I am sick from drinking that cheap wine. Sick. And I got those bad tremors, and I'm throwing up the dry heaves and bile. If you ever had drove through that, it's nasty stuff. And I feel like I'm going to jump out of my skin. My nerves are shot. And I'm sitting there in this park, and I'm just a mess. And I watch these cars pull up, and this truck, and all these church people get out, and they're heading across the park for a pavilion very much like this, with picnic tables. And then one guy's got a dolly, and they're pushing a keg of beer across that park. And I swear to God, like it was outlined in neon. I mean, I'm watching that keg of beer, and it's, oh my God. Oh. And I'm so sick. And it's Sunday, and there's nowhere to get a drink, and it's bad. And I try to psych myself together, and I'm a mess. And I go over there, and there's this very kind woman there. And I said, and a couple guys that are looking at me like, get out of here. Because I got hair down to here that's all matted and dirty, and I got a long beard. I think I fancied myself a ZZ Top tryout. And I got I tremors and sores, and I'm dirty. I've gone to the bathroom on myself, and I've been walking around in it for I don't know how long. I'm a mess. And so some of the people are looking at me like, get out of here. But this one lady, she saw me and she felt sorry for me, and I just went up to her. I was like crying. I said, I need a beer. I'm coming apart here. I'm afraid I'm going to have seizures. And she was a very kind Christian woman, and she went and got this big glass of some sort, filled it up and gave it to me. Oh man, it was amazing. And I started drinking this beer, but I can't keep it down, and I threw up in the corner of the pavilion on the ground. And these other guys that have been glaring at me, who I didn't like, come over and they start telling me what I am. And the problem is that what they're saying is the truth, and I can't argue with it. And I'm too sick and shaky and weak to fight them. And they gave me these dirty rags out of the trash bin, and they made me get down on my hands and knees and clean up this beer and slime that I'd thrown up on the corner of the thing, as they're standing around me telling me what I am. You should be ashamed of yourself. You're an animal. You're filthy. You smell. And everything they're saying to me is true. Our book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. How do you get there? I was the guy that was accepted to Ivy League colleges. I was the guy that, if I wouldn't have been thrown out of high school for possession of marijuana, I would have been valedictorian of my senior class. Right? How do you get there? And how do I get here? One takes something that's extraordinary, called alcoholism, and the other one takes something that is extraordinary. It is God's grace. And they're both cunning, baffling, and powerful, and hard to understand. You can't understand alcoholism will do to you what it's going to do to you until it's done to you what it's done to you. And you can't believe or accept or even conceive that God's grace can do for you in AA what it's going to do for you until it's done for you, and one day you stand up in the middle of a life you can't believe or deserve. And you know it. And you know it. I shouldn't have been an alcoholic. Well, I didn't sign up for it. I wasn't in the 11th grade with a guidance counselor and said, you know, I think I'm going to apply to some Ivy League schools, but I really want to be a guy living on the streets thinking about killing himself. I didn't, that's not part of the plan. And I didn't come from an alcoholic home, which was confusing to me because in the years I was in and out of AA, it sounded at times like your alcoholism was the fault of your parents. Well, your parents were alcoholics, of course, but my parents were not alcoholic. Now, I had alcoholism in my family. I suppose if there is any genetic basis to it, it hopscotched around. But my mother and father were wonderful people. They loved me. They had done anything to help me. I had a great childhood. But even in the midst of a life, a childhood of love and opportunity and nurturing, was a guy that there was just something wrong with him. I couldn't have explained it to you. I couldn't have put it into words, but I got a squirminess inside of me that kind of drives at me a little bit. And I have this thing where I don't feel like other people look. I have this inability to connect with people the way I observe them connecting with each other. This intimacy thing, this friendship, this one-of thing is vacant to me. I don't know how to do that. So I do what guys like me have done throughout history. I become a driven pretend kind of guy. I become the guy who pretends he's not afraid. I become the guy who pretends he's okay. I become the guy who pretends he's tough. I become the guy who pretends he's cool. He pretends he's a part of. And the more I pretend, the squirmier I am inside and the more anxious I am about being found out. And it's a losing game. And thank God, when I was almost 13 years old, this squirmy thing that ain't right with me, that I can't even define or talk about, was touched for the first time by alcohol. An event that would literally change the course of my life, unbeknownst to me. And I could tell you a lot about the details of what happened that first drunk, but basically what it comes down to is when I started drinking that alcohol, after a little while, I started to feel so good that the way I would be without that effect from that moment on was never, ever going to be enough again for me. And unbeknownst to me, getting lit up just moved into the center of my life. And I started to live for it. Now, when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, you can't get lit up every day, but I got lit up every chance I could get. But there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me when I'm not drinking, and there's something wrong with me when I'm drinking. But I don't see it. But I get in a lot of trouble. And what's wrong with me? I have this inability to shut her down when you should. I always go a little too far. I don't just get drunk, I get drunk. And when I'm drunk, there's some stuff seems like a good idea. Not a good idea. And so by the time I'm just about 16 years old, I'm standing before a juvenile court judge, same judge, third time. It's Judge Hess in Reading, Pennsylvania, and he looked like the meanest guy on the planet. I think he was actually probably a pretty nice guy, but he really, to me, looked like, whoa. And they're talking about locking me up somewhere with a bad reputation for kids and abuse. And I'm scared. and I'm trying to look cocky. And my mother and father are in that courtroom because my mother and father loved me. And my mother and father would have done anything to help me. I'm sad to have to tell you that years later, I broke their heart over and over and over again and stole from them over and over and over again and disappointed them over and over and over again. And one of the worst things I did to them is I kept getting up on my feet again and they'd get hope and then I'd smash it one more time. Until finally, years later, they would have nothing to do with me. But at that point, when I'm almost 16 years old, they'd have mortgaged their house, they'd have done anything to help me. And that they made a deal with the judge, and instead of going to the bad place to go, I had to go somewhere else and live for a while with a place with a lot of discipline, but at least there was no abuse, and it was a better deal. Well, when you're like me, and now I've been sober now a long period of time, because I always get sober when I'm in trouble. Did you ever notice that? But the trouble always wears off after a while. That's the problem. And so I've been sober a while, and I haven't been lit up for a while, but I'm overdue. And I go to this new place, and I'm scared, and I don't fit anywhere. And when you're coming from behind, like I am, what I always do is I try to target the guys that look like they got the juice, the guys that look like they have it going on, because you want to, if you're like me, you want to side up and kind of hang out with those guys. Maybe some of their something will rub off on some of my nothing, right? And so I've targeted the guys that look like they're all of that, and they've got something going on, and I'm talking to one of the guys. I'm there at this new joint maybe a week or so, and I'm telling him my story. You know how we do when you meet people, you want to tell them how bad you are. You know how you do. And you, if you're like me, it's not legitimate because you got to enhance it a little bit, you know? Right, you know. That fight I got in with the one guy, it was five guys. You know, I'm that guy, right? And so I'm telling him my story about the gang I run around with and, you know, what we do and everything. And he says something to me that was music to my ears. He said, "So you like to party, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do." Oh, I thought maybe he's going to reach in and pull out a pint of 151 rum because I was over ready. Instead, he doesn't pull out no pint. Instead, he says to me, he says, "Oh, you drink that liquor. That liquor makes you stupid." Now, he's backing me right up because that was the deal, man. At that point in my life, I loved 151 rum. That takes you downtown now. Man, just... I'm kind of getting chills just thinking about it. Let me tell you something. If there's any 151 rum drink, anybody here ever drink 151 rum? Let me tell you something. I don't care what you told yourself. There's no social drink in a 151 rum. That ain't happening. There's no such thing. There's no social drinking of Everclear. It's just you drink that stuff for one reason and one reason only. It's like, bam, get there and get there quick. I love that stuff. I loved it, man. And he's bad rapping it. Now he's backing me off. I'm thinking, I don't want to be around this guy. And then he says to me something nobody had ever said to me. He says, "What if I told you I could give you something to make you feel maybe as good as that 151 rum? Only they won't smell it on your breath. You won't slur your words. You won't stagger. Matter of fact, nobody can even tell you're high. And you could keep a whole week's supply in your shirt pocket. What would you say to that?" Well, I don't even know what he's talking about, but it's like, sign me up. And he introduced me to drugs. I got to tell you something. I'm a real alcoholic. Alcoholics should not do drugs. Oh, it's bad. Oh, my God, because I do drugs alcoholically. I'm trying to reproduce the effect of a pint of 151, so every drug I pick up, I slam it and me with it up against the wall. I can't get enough. In no time at all, I'm shooting speed. But I don't just shoot speed like guys that shoot speed. I've got guys that have been doing this 3, 4, 5 years saying things to me. "Hey, kid, you better cool it." I'm a maniac. In just a few months, maybe 7, 8 months, I don't know, not very long, I turned myself into some kind of paranoid schizophrenic. I became the guy, if you left me alone in your car and you went in to get cigarettes, by the time you came back, I'm trying to dismantle your dashboard looking for microphones from the police, right? Because I'm so nuts, right? I can't even have confidence.
anybody anymore. Because, you know, a bunch of guys will be standing around talking, and I'll blurt something into the conversation that would have been cool 2 minutes ago. And I'm just, and a guy comes along and he says, "Hey, try some of this." And he hits me up with something, and when the throwing up stopped, everything, my whole spin in my head stopped, everything went, introduced me to heroin. But I'm a real alcoholic. Alcoholics should not do drugs, I'm telling you. I took that to the wall and methadone clinics and pills. And eventually, after I burnt everybody off out and ripped everybody off, eventually I came full circle back to alcohol. I came full circle back to alcohol because it was something I could count on. And I don't know why I did drugs. I think when I, about the time I started doing them, people in my family were starting to use that A word on me, alcoholic. And I got an uncle that's an alcoholic, and I'd rather die than be like that jerk. I ain't no alcoholic. So when I was doing drugs, we used to look down on alcoholics. Well, we felt sorry for you. But I had the disease of alcoholism. And I've always had the disease of alcoholism, and I didn't know it. You know, I went through treatment center after treatment center, God, from the time I was probably 19, 20 years old till I finally got sober in 78. I went through a bunch of these treatment centers, and they would tell me crazy things in there. And they would ask me crazy things in there. Like, when you're checking in, they'll say things to you like, "What's your drug of choice? What do you got?" I mean, I drank vanilla extract. In jail, I broke open a magic marker one time and huffed it, just hoping something would happen. You know, here's what they should have asked me, and they asked me the wrong question. They should have said, in order to find out if I had alcoholism, they should have asked me about the single defining characteristic of alcoholism. Because if you got that, it doesn't matter if you did all that other stuff. If you got that, you got alcoholism. And what that is, it's an allergic reaction to alcohol that is manifested by a phenomenon of craving. And I got to tell you something. I have had that since day one. I drank a lot of years. I have never once been partying with a bunch of guys, smoking shit, drinking wine. Never once had the guy come over to me or the bartender after I'm sitting there for about an hour and say to me, "Hey, Bob, would you like another drink?" I have never had the experience of thinking, "No, this is just right." Every drink of alcohol I've ever taken made me feel like I yearn for more of that feeling, more of a high. Now, sometimes I'll take a right turn, sometimes take a left turn, but every time I ever took a drink, I broke out in a phenomenon of craving for more. Every single time. There's a test in the big book. I don't recommend it. I used to watch people recommend it. I think it's a stupid test. And it says, you know, if you're not sure if you're alcoholic, maybe you think you're something else. Maybe you think you're a drug addict. Maybe you think you're something else. Maybe you think you got just emotional problems. I tell you, we would rather be just about anything than alcoholic. Most of us would rather be a mental health case. At least then you get pills. Most of us would like to be anything other than alcoholic. But the test in the book, it says, okay, you don't think you're an alcoholic? Here, go down the road here. Go down to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and then stop abruptly. Well, if you've got the mind of a chronic alcoholic, a mind that is against you, a mind that services the disease of alcoholism, it's a bad test. Because if I go in this bar and I'm going to see if I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to have two drinks and that's it and shut her down. Now you can't smoke nothing, take nothing, two drinks, that's it. Well, about halfway through the second drink, it's going to become very apparent to me that this is a bad test day. My God, did you see that girl? Oh, that could be her. You know who her is, capital letters, her. That could be her. Joe would come in. He's got some good reefer. Got to have a drink with Joe. Oh, my God, that game's on. I didn't know that game was on. I can't leave now. Bad test day. Tomorrow be a better test day. And I go into the bar tomorrow to try the test. Somewhere as the effect of alcohol starts to hit me, it's like a key turns in my head, and I break out in an irresistible yearning to get higher, and it punks me out because it uses my own mind against me, and I think it's my idea. And I'm burning my life to the ground, and when they say it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, they're not kidding. And some of us lay in gutters and in jail cells, and we don't know how the hell we got here. How did this happen to us? I used to say something to myself, and every time I'd come off a run, I'd find myself cursing myself and saying this one word, and it would just make me, crazy. I'd look around and I'd say to myself, "Again, Bob? Again?" And I felt so out of control, and I can't stop what's happening to me. The last couple of years, it was pretty much just alcohol, pretty much Richard's Wild Irish Rose. I recommend it. It's never seen a grape. I recommend it highly. My whole life came down to economics. Let's buy the most amount of Blot Bob out for the least amount of money. And cheap 20% alcohol wine, usually one. Sometimes it'd be cheap vodka, but most of the time, the cheap wine won. And I entered into a stage of alcoholism that was bleak. It's so heartbreaking that something that at one time had been so magnificent could turn on us and become so horrific. But at one time, drinking was, man, it was the deal. I mean, one time getting high was, I mean, my God, what a magic effect it was. A guy like me could walk into a dance or a bar, and I'm so locked up in my head and depressed and worried about crap, I can't even talk to anybody. Just leave me alone. And I could have three or four double shots, and I'd get free. Five double shots, and I loved everybody. I love you, man. I used to hang around with a gang of guys. We'd get lit up and say things to each other like, "I'll die for you, man." When you're a mope who don't fit nowhere, that's amazing. I could drink and I could play the guitar and sing better than I could play the guitar. And this is not illusionary. I really could. I just get loose. I could drink and shoot pool and almost see, like, I get in that zone I can't miss. I could get half lit up in the early days and I could talk to girls, and I can't talk to girls sober. You get me half lit up. I remember this experience. I hope I never forget. There was a girl. I went to this dance. I had this crush on this girl. I could not ask her to dance. I could not even talk to her. I was so locked up inside myself. And I drank. I went out in the parking lot and drank with some guys. I came back in there. I started talking to her, and I had an out-of-body experience. I'm listening to myself say things to her. I don't know where the words are coming from. But I remember getting excited, thinking, "Oh my God, this is going to work." Oh. It's like I was channeling somebody. You know, it was amazing. It was amazing. You know, if it wasn't for, I probably shouldn't say this, if it wasn't for alcohol, I think we'd all be celibate to this day. Oh, it was amazing. But in the progression of the disease, what happens is over the years, that effect is bleeding out on me. And I can't, it's getting more and more elusive, and it starts to get horrible. And I frantically, desperately try to get back to those magic days, and I can't get it back. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I start going to psychiatrists. I start taking medications. I work out. I get hypnotized and regress back into my childhood because even though I had a nice family, I suspect that I might have been damaged. Maybe I was mispotty trained or something. I don't know. But so I felt damaged. There was something wrong with me. I tried everything. And I don't know what it is. And I can't be alcoholism.
And I'll tell you why I don't think it's alcoholism. Because I'm going to many, many, many of your meetings. I'm forced to go in every institution I was ever in. Isn't that funny? It's a funny mentality that you're not alcoholic, but every time you drink, you end up where they have the alcoholics grouped. Isn't that a weird deal? But I'd go to the meetings, and I would listen to you, and I would observe you. And I know that whatever's wrong with me is not really the same thing that's wrong with you. You see, because I watch you and I listen to you, and my God, you're great. I mean, sometimes I hate you for what's happened in your life, but you have wonderful jobs and great marriages and relationships, and you're happy and you laugh a lot, and you're very connected to people. And I stop drinking, and abstinence feels like I'm doing time. I stop drinking, and I suffer from depression. I go to the psychiatrist, and they give me what is the legitimate treatment for clinical depression, and it doesn't really work. It works a little bit for a little while, and eventually I'll go back to drinking and harder drugs. Because it's not clinical depression. It looks like it. If I was a psychiatrist and I did work as a therapist for a while, I would probably diagnose a guy like me as clinically depressed. But it's a misdiagnosis. What I really have is spiritual depression. I have the depression of a guy that when he stops drinking and taking drugs, just gets his emotions and his life and his past and his future just on him, like that creature in the movie Alien that attaches itself to your face. And I start smothering myself with myself. It always feels like somebody had crimped the oxygen hose to my being. And we all have the same experience. 6 months like that, you take the first drink, we all do the same thing. Somebody turned the air back on. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but I know it ain't the same thing that's wrong with you. In 1978, I tried to take my own life. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't think I was dying of alcoholism. If I could have been legitimate and I could have told you how I felt, I probably would have told you it felt like I was dying of loneliness because I don't fit anywhere drinking anymore and I don't fit anywhere sober. And I don't know what's wrong with me. But I come to in the park. I've been thrown out of another halfway house. I'm facing a couple years in prison and because I was put in there by a judge in Pennsylvania in lieu of 2 years, and the 2 years now is coming to be coming at me. And I come to in this park, and I'm haunted by the words of a doctor from a detox earlier that year. And he told me, as they examined me, he gave me a physical, he said that I was young enough, I was in my 20s, and physically fit enough that I could probably go on like I was going on for another 5 years or more before it actually killed me. And I came to that morning and I thought, 5 years of this? I ain't doing 5 weeks more of this. I'd rather be dead. And I'm not afraid of dying. I don't think you can't threaten. You know, most alcoholics say, keep drinking, it's going to kill you. Yeah, when? When? Automobiles and motorcycles, and we pick fights with people that sometimes we think it might kill us. Because we, at the end, it's almost like, kill me. Kill me! Get it over with. I mean, you can eventually drink yourself to death, but my God, it takes a long time. It's like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just goes on and on and on. And that's why most of us start thinking about killing ourselves. Because we can't hang. It's just too brutal. It's just, and in the process of dying of alcoholism, you break the heart of everyone that ever loves you. By the time you're finally dead, everybody who wanted their approval and meant something to you hates you. There's a guy on Vegas that I got sober with his dad in 1978. And his son was about probably 3 years old or four. His son, I remember going to visit him. We were in the detox together, and he invited me over to his house where he's. And his son, man, his son just kept looking up at his dad, man. His dad was his hero. And Bill never got sober. And over the next few years, Bill just relapsed and relapsed, and he hated himself, and he'd take it out on his wife, and he'd take it out on the kids, and he didn't mean to, and he hated himself for it, but he couldn't help it because he hates anybody that would love the person he hates the most. And he's dead. And it's 20 some years since he died of alcoholism. And I run into his son on the streets, and he remembers that I was friends with his dad. And he'll, if you bring up his dad, he'll start telling you with venom what an asshole his dad was 20 years later. And Bill, I'll tell you something, that boy was Bill's heart. But that's what happens in alcoholism. Right before I left Pennsylvania, I was sleeping on a guy's couch, and he was kind to me. I didn't have a place to live the last couple of years, because I used to be the guy. I'd come off a run, and I'd dig my way out, and I'd get a good job and a girlfriend, maybe a motorcycle, get a guitar, get all that stuff, get rolling again. But the last couple of years, I don't get up no more. Because what's the point? Because I know what's going to happen. I know before the year's out, I'm going to be in a freaking gutter again, so I just might as well not stray too far from it. And I didn't try anymore. And I'm sleeping on this guy's couch, and he's about fed up with me. I'm not a good house guest. Well, when you go to bed, I'll drink the rest of your alcohol. I'll steal your stash. I'll pick your change up. I'll wet your couch. I'll put cigarette holes in your stuff. You know, I don't mean to, but I pass out with a lit cigarette. I'm that guy. I am not a good house guest. And so, but he's tolerating me getting thin on it, but I come to one morning on his couch, and I am a mess, man. I get those bad tremors. This part of my drinking, the end of it, my drinking is not a party. It's pathetic. I come to with the shakes and full of self-pity and terror, that fear that just gets on you, and you don't know what you're afraid of, but my God, it's like everything. It's a terror. And I got those shakes, and I got to get something to drink, and I start hustling around for money, and I found two rolled up dollar bills in the bottom of my dirty jeans, and there's some change over there, and some change in there. Put it all together, and I got enough money for a half gallon Richard's Wild Irish Rose. This is a promising day. And I go out to that state store. It's early in the morning because Pennsylvania is a bad deal. Because you come to at 3 a.m. and need a drink, you've got to pace for a lot of hours to wait for that liquor store to open up. That's a bad deal. And I'd always get down to that state store a half hour before they open, and I'd try to look pathetic and pitiful in front of those glass windows, hoping they'd open early. They never open early. And I'm in there, I'm looking pathetic. They finally, right on time, they open the door. I get in there, I get my half gallon of wine. Now I'm in a hurry to get down an alley somewhere and get well. Well, before I get down an alley and get well, I run into this woman who knows my mother and father in Reading. This woman says to me, she says, "How's your dad?" I don't know. I haven't talked. My parents don't talk. They won't talk to me. I'm not welcome in their house. They'll hang up on me if I. I mean, I've really hurt them. I stole so much from my dad. There was one pawn shop in Reading. My dad became friends with the guy who owned it from buying his own stuff back. And then the guy cut me off and wouldn't take nothing from me anymore. And I say, "I don't know." And she says, "I hear your dad's in the hospital and he's dying." Oh, man, I felt like I was gut shot. You see, I loved my father. And the idea of him dying, man, is making me crazy because I have a lot of things I need to say to him. I have a lot of guilt and shame and remorse and things I need to tell him how sorry I am. And I get away from her, and I get down an alley, and I drink about half of that jug of wine, and I have enough change left over for a phone call, and I go to a pay phone, and I call my parents' house, and my mother answers the phone. The minute she hears my voice, it's like, what do you want? And I said to her, I said, Mom, I hear Dad's in the hospital. And she paused for a moment, and when she answered me, you could hear the tears in her voice. And she said, yeah, and we don't know if he's going to make it. Man, this is killing me. And I said to her, I said, Mom, there's three hospitals in that town. I said, Mom, what hospital is he at? I've got to go see him. And she won't tell me. She says, you can't see him. I said, please, Mom, I have to see him. I have to talk to him. I have to see him. She says, I know how you are. It will hurt him to see you how you are. And I'm begging her. And I said, Mom, I promise you, I will not drink anything. I will not take any drugs. I promise you, I'll be sober. I'll get cleaned up. I promise you. And she said, you can't fool with this. He can, even if you think you're going to get high a little bit, he can tell. And my dad could. My dad could tell on the other end of the phone I was high when I'm not really that high. I don't know how he does that, but he could do that. And I said, I promise. And she tells me what hospital he's in, and I can't go that day because I already started drinking. But I'm going to go tomorrow morning because I've got to see my dad. I love my dad. Well, I go partying the rest of the day, finish off that jug. I end up with some guys. I don't even know what we did. I went to a blackout. I was a blackout drinker. Come to on that sofa with those tremors and those shakes, and I'm thinking about seeing my dad. But I got this terror on me. And the idea of walking over to Reading Hospital and walking down those clean, shiny halls where all those clean people are, and they're going to be looking at me. And sober, I don't even like people looking at me. I feel ashamed. And I'm scared, and I'm shaking, and I got these bad tremors. And I start having a conversation with myself. And I got to tell you, an alcoholic who's having a conversation with himself is in a lot of trouble. And it's going something like this. Well, for God's sakes, Bob, you can't let your dad see you with the shakes. That's not good. What you need, Bob, is you need just about a half a pint of vodka. They can't smell vodka. You take some of those Halls cough drops. Use your roommate. The guy you're staying with has some Aramis cologne in his bathroom. Throw a little bit of that on. Little Visine. Put your cleanest clothes on. Get cleaned up. Go see your dad. That sounds like a reasonable plan. I'm not going to get drunk. Just I need a half a pint just to stop this. Well, I start rummaging around, and I don't know what I did the night before, but I ended up with over $4. That was, I don't know how. Sometimes I'd come to, and the whole paycheck would be gone. Everything would be broke. And other times I'd come to with money, and I don't know where it came from. And I think blackouts may be a blessing. And I got over $4, and I don't know where, but I can get a fifth of the cheap vodka at the state store for $3.95. I don't need a fifth, I need a half a pint, but I know I'm going to want the rest of that fifth when I come back from that hospital. So I go down and get that fifth of vodka and drink the half a pint. Well, I'm an idiot. Every drink of alcohol I've ever taken my whole life takes my mind and twists it around. So one more. Next thing I know, I'm better than halfway through the fifth of vodka. Now I'm too rummy to go to that hospital and pull it off. And I'm sitting there with this bottle that's starting to get empty of vodka, crying, feeling sorry for myself because my dad's going to die and I'm not going to be able to see him. And I tried to pump myself up and I tried to tell myself, tomorrow, Bob, for God's sakes, tomorrow you can't drink anything tomorrow. You've got to go see your dad. My God, you've got to see your dad. And I'm sad to tell you, I never did get to see my father because the next day and the day after that and every day that week was the same. And if you think I didn't love my father, you're out of your damn mind. But alcoholism does that to guys like me. And the progressive nature of the disease, it starts to just erode everything of value out of your life until you're a vacant, hollow shell. And then you just try to get up enough courage to kill yourself. I heard a story a few years ago that just nailed this disease for me. A dear friend of mine, one of his best friends, was diagnosed as terminally ill with stomach cancer. And this is a sad deal, I know. My mother was terminally ill from cancer, and when I was 17 years sober, I got to take care of her, and she went down to 50 pounds and then died. And he was very sad when he heard about the stomach cancer of his friend. And about 3 months went by, and then he heard that a surgeon had surfaced that was going to perform surgery. And he got excited. He thought, oh my God, finally they found a surgeon who knows what he's doing. It's going to take that cancer out. And he called over and got the guy's mom on the phone. He says, hey, I hear they're going to perform surgery and take the cancer out. And his mom says, well, they're going to perform the surgery, but they're not going to take the cancer out. He says, they're not? Well, why are they going to do the surgery? He says, well, they're forced to cut out sections of his stomach and intestines and liver and internal organs to make room for the growth of the tumors, so his last days on earth are not excruciatingly painful. And alcoholism is very much like that. If your job or your career gets in the way of the progression of the disease and time, alcoholism will cut that out of your life. If your parents get in the way of the progression of the disease and time, alcoholism will cut them out of your life. If your self-respect gets in the way, or your morals or your values, you're going to leave them in the dirt. My God, by the time some of us get sober, we look back over our lives, it's like looking down railroad tracks, only those aren't railroad ties. Those are all the lines we said we'd never cross. And somehow we're on this side of them. Even your children, who you may love more than life itself, in time, alcoholism will cut them out of your life. I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens of men and women who have loved their kids have lost their kids through alcoholism. And then I'm also glad to tell you I've had the experience of being up close and personal to men and women that through the steps, especially step 8 and 9, and in time, in God's grace, they were able to get their kids back. There is just as much restoration from Alcoholics Anonymous as there was deterioration from alcoholism. The problem is that the Alcoholics Anonymous will fix you in time, and it is a treatment for alcoholism. The bad news, it don't work as fast as 5 shots of tequila. And it's a slow process. In 1978, I only got a couple minutes. In 1978, I came off this failed suicide attempt. I tried to commit suicide, because I'm a coward, I couldn't pull it off. And I ended up, somehow, through a bizarre set of circumstances, hitchhiking and running from the law, I ended up in a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada. I wasn't trying to go to Vegas. I was trying to go to California. It was as far as I could get. I was so sick when I got there. They put me in this hospital, and after they had me on IVs for a while, and they got me stabilized, they finally got me some clothes to wear, because the clothes I wore, they couldn't even keep them in the center. They had to burn them. They were bad. And they let me go to meetings of AA in there. And I remember going into this meeting in this demoralized state. Now, you've got to remember, I have tried with everything in me. I've tried every branch of therapy, every medication. I've tried church. I've tried everything I can to either do one of two things. Either to make my drinking okay like it was in the good old days, or to make abstinence bearable. And I have failed at both, and I have failed at killing myself. And when you think about it objectively, if drinking is awful and not drinking is awful, and you can't even kill yourself, what the hell's left except Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, it really is the last house on the block. I mean, this is God's waiting room here. I mean, and I in that hospital, I met my first sponsor, who had pushed me into service and pushed me into involvement in the fellowship. And I went to a meeting when I was fairly new, out of the detox, out of the hospital, and a guy cornered me after the meeting named Joe. And Joe had helped me a lot when I was new. He was not my sponsor, but he helped me a lot. And Joe said to me, he says, kid, you need to take step 3. And I looked on the board at the 12 steps, and I read step 3 to myself, and I said, Joe, I can't take step 3. He says, why not? I said, the truth is, Joe, I don't know if there's a God or not. I don't really believe in God. And Joe says, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I said, but that's what it says. Joe made a decision to turn our will and our lives under the care of God as we understand him. I don't understand him. I don't even know if there is a God. He says, listen, kid. He says, if you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair, and he points to a chair in the meeting room, he says, I promise you an instant miracle. So I thought, what the hell? I turn my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? Joe gets a big smile. He says, oh, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. I didn't even know I was surrendered enough not to get mad. I just, when he said that, I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yeah. Because if you'd have followed me around and observed me for years, maybe as your loved ones and friends and family have observed you, whoever's watching us would easily come to the conclusion that whoever's making decisions for this guy is out to destroy him. But it never looks that way in here. I had a great guy come in my face when I was early sobriety, a rough old guy, and he says, listen, kid, I'm going to tell you a couple things that are going to save you a lot of grief and a lot of pain. And I said, what, Dale? He said, listen, kid, I want you to know, if you're explaining something, if you're defending something, if you're rationalizing something, or if you're justifying something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. Because you never have to explain, defend, or justify what's right. 30 years later, probably, that is so as true today as it was then. All the defensiveness is aspects of the ego, which is my enemy. I almost died of alcoholism, not from alcohol, but from an ego that made me a smart guy. From an ego that made me fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much. I was unsponsorable, I was unteachable, and I couldn't listen to you unless I already agreed with you, which made the people that I would listen to probably weren't going to stay sober more than a week anyway. And in 1978, I started to throw myself at this simple program. And that's who in this meeting will survive and get lit up. And your life is going to turn around. And those in this meeting that are going to die that horrible death, slow death where you relapse yourself to death. And the difference between the ones that make it and the ones that don't, it's read at every meeting. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I implore you to make AA the center of your life. And at the very least, you will get your life out of the hands of an idiot. Thank you for listening.